Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we're going to talk about the science debate that's going raging everywhere. My guest, Sean Otto, believes that there's a war on science. And he's right in a lot of ways, because science has been so politicized that all these big issues, whether it's climate change, whether it's fluoride in the water, whether you're talking about autism from vaccines or vaccines in general, it's all been politicized. And so you aren't able to get at the core of science. People don't care about what the scientific results are. They're just trying to forward their agenda. And we've lost so much into that process, because science should really be an objective debate where you don't get all emotional. But it's hard. It's like the tobacco industry. When you research what the tobacco industry did in this country and they confuse things on purpose to keep legislation from going through, then you can see what's really going on everywhere. And you can see the tobacco industry doing that now in Indonesia and some other countries. So it's still going on with them. And that's what we're dealing with a lot of political issues now in science. But it's getting to a level of discourse where it's ridiculous and we need to rein it back in. Now, a lot of people will not agree with him on where he comes out on some of these scientific debates, but it doesn't matter, because his process and what he's trying to get at is so good that it'll flush those things out in the long run anyways. And that's why I wanted to talk to Sean Otto today. So I don't want to waste much more time, because the interview is pretty long and I want to get as much as I can in. So here's Sean Otto and the War on Science. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for joining me today. I am going to talk to you about science. You've been on this crusade lately about the war on science. Can you educate us a bit what you mean by the war on science? What do you mean by that? And what do you see going on?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, science is by its nature never partisan, never right nor left, but it's always political, because science creates knowledge. Knowledge is power, and power affects your ability to act in the world. And that has a political currency. So there are often, when science makes certain discoveries that suggest some kind of regulatory response, there are often people who argue with that. And many of those actors right now are particularly involved in arguing with the science on a number of different fields.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's happened all through history, hasn't it? As far as, you know, the famous one with Galileo, I don't remember her name, but she came up with washing your hands. He came up with washing sand. This is the big 1920s, 30s, and it completely changed medicine. And then there's another woman that came up with the x-rays with fetals, and that took, you know, that it hurts fetuses. That took about 30 years to come through, even though the evidence was really clear. Go ahead.
Discoveries. I was going to just say that that's right, that usually new discoveries disrupt or challenge people's accepted beliefs or ideological or economic positions. So there's often somewhat of a battle as they work their way through society.
Well, how else do you see this displayed in society? I mean, what are you seeing right now?
Well, there are really three fronts, I say, in this war on science. One comes it's rooted in postmodernist thinking in academia that has really grown up since World War II, that teaches that there are a variety of equally valid worldviews, and that no one of those worldviews is better than any other, including the worldview that there is such a thing as objective truth, and that science is a method that can get at that. So there are fields that have been taught under this method or under this thinking for about 40 or 50 years now, and they include some education programs and, in particular, journalism. Since 1996, the Society of Professional Journalists removed the goal or the precept of objectivity from their code of ethics. And since that time, we've seen really a market shift in the way that journalists approach stories and a growth in anti-science claims and a slipping in the public's ability to really understand what is real in certain circumstances and what are not. What that's done is that's opened up a vast airplane hangar size inroad for ideological and economic actors who don't like what science says. And those are the other two fronts in the war on science. The old saw about how evolution really is science, or how any kind of creationism, whatever you may call it, might be scientific, teaching alternative theories to that, the idea that vaccines may cause autism, and this has some certain religious components now, whether or not we should be teaching sex education, and what the evidence says about abstinence-only education. So there's been a large, perhaps over the last 35 years, movement of organized thinking in evangelical conservative religion who see that what science says about human origins is intruding on a literalist interpretation of the Bible and on God's turf. And so they have mounted a lot of methods of coming up with alternative theories that explain what science purports to explain, they say. The other front, then, that has really began to work in concert with those actors are large corporations where the science, either health or environmental science, is suggesting some kind of regulatory response that poses a cost to their bottom line. And instead of adjusting their business model, they've invested in large-scale public relations campaigns to create uncertainty about what the science says.
Well, that happened with the tobacco industry, and it still is in countries that are, you know, not regulated. They put out whole campaigns to try to sway people. We know what the science is now. It creates lung cancer. It's not good for you. But, you know, some of the science, like on some of these really controversial issues like vaccines, I've had some conversations with people who are worried about the science behind the vaccines. Not that they don't work, but that the science of taking multiple vaccines at once hasn't been tested. And so we don't know what, I mean, because there's a lot of people that are reacting from vaccines. And because the science simply hasn't been done on multiple vaccines at once, the compromising to your immune system hasn't, there's no proof one way or the other. So, you know, the science is still out there in some of these controversial issues. And it seems like there's a religious tendency towards one or the other, regardless, even if it's not religious, you know, it's not the Bible, but it seems like they almost get religious in believing on one side or the other, and they'll do anything to take down the other side, you know, instead of having an objective scientific debate about it.
They do, although an objective scientific debate is not necessarily a debate where the preponderance of the evidence is on one side of an argument and somebody comes up and says, I don't think that's right. If there isn't an opinion about a single scientific study, as we see from, for instance, the food industry, where we're constantly hearing red wine is good for you, red wine is bad for you, chocolate's good for your chocolate, all that stuff. Those are usually based on single studies, which are almost worthless. The next best thing to an opinion. When science really begins to take on reliability statistically is when study after study after study begins to point different lines of evidence all towards the same conclusion.
Patterns,
yes, statistical patterns. Which is why statistics is really important. That's how we measure and record the probability that something that we perceive is actually true. And so this works not only in the experimental method in science and not only in data collection or in doing an epidemiological study. It also works in the overall way that science approaches a problem. So if there's a lot of literature, meaning the results of scientific experiments, papers published on a certain topic that is indicating something, that has a much more reliable base of support that we can count on it being reasonably reliable, that it's true. Then if someone comes up with something that says, wait a minute, I'm going to challenge that, something that we need to always be open to, because that's how we sometimes refine or expand our knowledge. Knowledge has rarely, if ever, been overturned, but it has been expanded. For instance, Newtonian physics is now a special category of Einsteinian physics. Einstein didn't overturn it, he expanded it. And that's happened a number of different times. So while we always have to be open to that, in those cases then, those scientists really need to present a very, very compelling case, because they are logically, not by politics or any other reason, but they're up against a mountain of statistical evidence that is pointing in a certain direction. So if they come up with something that's contrary to that, either A, it's a statistical blip, because that happens all the time, a counter indication that doesn't necessarily mean that you're right. So then you have to confirm it over and over, have other people confirm it, make sure there's no accidents, etc. You need to establish your case, or you need to have something that is just profoundly compelling and that's easily replicable.
That makes sense.
So then when there's a scientific debate, the debate isn't just warring opinions saying, this is my evidence and I think that's right. No, this is my evidence and I think that's right. That's not the way scientists debate. That's the way lawyers debate. When scientists debate, they also bring in then kind of the accumulation of knowledge and the statistical weight that has. That's why you hear the word consensus in science. It's not about a consensus of opinions. It's about a consensus of conclusions that are pointing in a certain direction.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, do you see this as more, is it happening more in the U.S.? Is this our worldwide deal going on?
It's worldwide, but it happens in different areas of science in different countries. For instance, in Australia right now, there's a large push to remove fluoride from public water supplies, despite the, you know, large statistical mountain of evidence that shows that it's a great benefit to human health, because it prevents tooth decay, which is associated then with heart disease and other public health problems. The opponents there think that fluoride, because it's some kind of chemical, they think is bad for you. And there's one paper, again, that suggested that it might impair intellectual development. But again, you have to look at that one paper versus, you know, a mountain of evidence. And where are you going to put your weight of reliability? Over 70 years in the United States, it doesn't seem to have had any reduction in our intellectual capacity. And fluoride occurs naturally in the water supply. In some cases, fluoridation actually means the level of fluoride, not increasing it. So you just want to make sure that it's balanced at a proper level. Just like if you take too much vitamin C, some science indicates that it might not be good for you. If you take too much of anything, it's not good for you. So you want to balance it. So that's just one example. That same thing is happening in several American cities. It's happening in Ireland, in Israel, in a number of European countries. There are large movements against the MMR vaccine in France in particular, but also in England and in some areas of Germany. There are large movements against genetically modified crops, particularly in China, where there's a very active and strong environmental movement, much stronger than in the United States right now, actually. But they have, for political reasons, come to believe that GM food is an American plot to do mind control with the Chinese.
Well, don't you think that genetically modified food, putting it all in one category as one big thing on all foods, doesn't quite make sense? Because if you genetically modify one type of food and you do it, you mess it up, that could be different than the 95% that actually you did a good job on. And it actually is helpful, right? I mean, to put it all into one category.
Well, there is a challenge that people get into when they think about genetically modified food. And that's, first of all, it's mixing up the politics with legal, ethical issues about whether or not a company should control a genome, or whether or not we should be designing organisms to work in concert with chemicals, as we do with, let's say, Roundup Ready corn, which then causes perhaps an overuse of glyphosate. So those are policy and moral and ethical discussions that are totally valid. There's actually a larger, when it comes to the question of whether or not genetically modified food is safe, there's actually a larger consensus of scientists and consensus of evidence, therefore, but particularly scientists, I guess. I can't say consensus of evidence, but certainly a consensus of scientists that say that genetically modified food is safe to eat, than there are that say that humans are causing climate change. That's because genetic modification, when you actually study it, it's not Frankensteinian. It's plant breeding, which we've done, but it's doing it more precisely.
Well, but
so it's not it's not a thing, it's a method.
Have we messed up the wheat crop to where we have all these gluten issues now? So where are all these gluten issues coming from? If, from my understanding, is the wheat crop that we used to eat throughout most of our history is different now, and so it's introduced all these gluten issues. So that's my understanding. I don't know. I'm not an expert on this particular field, but my point is, it makes sense that we could genetically modify something to a point where it's not good for us anymore, and we just haven't done the science on it. And
yes, well, part of that, though, in the case of wheat, that's not you, that's from monoculture wheat plant we've done, you know, since the quote-unquote Green Revolution, not directly tied to genetic modification, but it's just towards the broad commercial use of one kind of wheat, that a certain segment of the population has not evolved to digest properly because of the gluten level in it. Now, that's an example of one thing that humans often get into with science, which is a problem, which is a great example, because pesticides are another one. We get into this thing where we see a method of science or a product like a pesticide or like monoculture, and we say, wow, that's going to feed the world, with the case of the Green Revolution, and with monoculture and with vast economies of scale. Let's dive right into that. And we do before we really have a chance to think through the systemic consequences it may have on human health or on the environment. And then maybe about 10 or 15 years later, we begin to see the evidence that, wait a minute, overdoing this really isn't such a good thing. And that we should take a step back, or we should regulate. And by that time, it sets up kind of battles on the corporate farming issue that have to do with science denial as well.
Well, and sugar is a good example. They put sugar mm-hmm. in absolutely everything now. And isn't there a pretty big sugar lobby that is involved? And there's all sorts of political things behind the scenes. And so now we got sugar in everything because people love it. I love sugar, but it's so bad for me. And now
right.
we know that. And it's in everything. It's really hard to buy things that don't have sugar in it. But sugar isn't naturally in most things.
Right. And the human body did not evolve to take in the high level. And that's another great example. The sugar industry actually paid for a bunch of bogus science to be done to suggest that the problems with human health really were not being caused by sugar, but were being caused by other factors. This has helped sugar through kind of the competitive phase after a market crash about 20 years ago, become so broadly used, because we didn't really think of it as a source of a lot of our health problems. So the food industry, in their competitive way of continually trying to grow their margins, realized that if you add a little bit of sugar, you can up your sales here, because it makes it taste better to a certain segment of the population, and it makes it a little bit more addictive too. And they did see great increases in sales. Then their competitors had to get into that too, and we saw kind of this war of sugar evolve as it really spread throughout most of our commercial food supply, which is a real big, big American health problem with obesity, with heart disease, with stroke. I mean, it's sugar that causes stroke, and people thought that it was, you know, eating red meat or something like that. Sugar is an abrasive to the inside of our blood vessels. But a lot of that kind of evidence really wasn't out in public discussion until much more recently.
Well, and sugar is so hard because it's more addictive than cocaine, right? I mean, it's just terrible. You get it out. I remember I was on a detox and my daughter dropped a Skittle when I was going back in to get, it was in my car and it was on the back seat just sitting there. And so I was cutting out sugar for like 3 weeks and there was a Skittle there. I remember just like, oh my God, I want that Skittle. That's terrible. But that's
how
I think I did. That's how addictive that sugar. I know I'm totally, but I try. I do the best I can. Because I know it screws up your health. It's really bad.
I am too. My dad's addicted to sugar and has had a terrible stroke because of his terrible diet around it. And that has really scared me, but I haven't stopped eating sugar. And that tells me something kind of about its addictive qualities. And in some ways, I think that interesting. I don't know of any science that has been done on this, but it's really interesting to chart the increase in sugar in the American diet and the increase in the American drug problem. I think that it may be acting sort of as a gateway drug because it bings those endorphins in the same way that drugs do and may create an artificial dependency that people move from one consumed item to another.
That's an interesting way to look at it because it makes sense. But it's one of those things that it would be so hard to change and get out of food because the people who do get it out versus the ones that people are still going to buy the ones that have the sugar because it tastes better.
Yeah, it's so difficult. And that's an ethical conversation that's going on in the industry right now because it really pits producing healthy food against producing profitable food back this addiction. So we've got kind of an industry that is economically addicted to putting sugar in the food supply now. And that's a good case. That's actually a really great example of where emerged science about human health comes in conflict with the profit structure kind of in almost an existential way of the industry, where the industry has kind of gotten into this almost Mexican standoff, to use a politically incorrect older term, but it's where each party is frozen into this competitive stance where if they back down first, they're probably going to be wiped out by their competitors. So that's a case where the government really needs to come in and regulate to level the playing field for everybody.
Well, and then it gets back to ethics of who gets to decide what people really need to eat. And, you know, are you into utilitarianism? Are you into individual rights? I taught ethics this year at the university. So, you know, I look at that and I'm like, well, you can see how, you know, if people want it, but it's so bad and so many people aren't conscious of what they're doing. But that's a very difficult social problem.
It is. It's a really interesting challenge from an ethical point of view, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. Okay, so I have talked to a lot of scientists. I my show, Business Game Changers, I'm looking for people on the edge. I look for people that, you know, if they have millions of people who are looking at different paradigm-changing ideas, I dive into it and I talk to them about it. And so consequently, I'm talking to scientists that are on the edge of a lot of different things. You know, some things are not controversial, but just so far on the edge. And other things are controversial ideas because it doesn't go with maybe the mainstream thought of how things are. And a lot of those people are saying that we're pretty much in a dark ages of science. It's kind of, if you don't follow the mainstream ideas, they just completely shut you out. And have you seen that? I mean, that's a historical precedence, right? That happens all through history.
Well, I think that that's part of human nature, right? Is that we all approach our way of navigating through the world by making kind of heuristics about it that are kind of shorthands that tell us that this is the way something is. And then if somebody comes along with kind of an iconoclastic idea that challenges that, it's almost human nature, if it's not economic nature or ideological nature, to kind of push back on that. Scientists get into trouble when they don't keep an open mind to that, to those kind of out-of-the-box ideas, because that's where the cutting edge of science is. But scientists also get into trouble when they are working on the cutting edge, when they don't tie their work back into the existing foundation of literature and expose themselves to being challenged by others, because really science's power comes from its falsifiability, the fact that it exposes itself to all comers and says, if you can knock this idea down, have at it. And the ideas that survive are the ones that are strong and that we can count on. So it's, science always has this tension in it, this kind of conundrum between how far out do you go and how close do you stick to the past? And that's kind of the, in a way, the liberal or progressive conservative tension. And that's why I say science is never really political, because it has to be both. It has to both account for what's come before and be open to the cutting edge. Otherwise, on the one hand, if you're not open to the cutting edge, you kind of eventually risk career stagnation because your thinking doesn't go anywhere. But if you're out on the cutting edge and you don't account for the knowledge that's come in the past, you kind of risk career suicide because your work can be knocked down. So you really don't want to be either. You want to be kind of out on the edge, pushing the bubble, but you want to incorporate existing knowledge.
Well, and I think the hard part is kind of like Tesla. He was so far out there that even though he probably incorporated, it was a linear path for him, he just went so far down that linear path so much faster than everybody, they couldn't connect those dots. And, you know, and so if you go too far past that linear path that everybody else is on without being able to connect them to it, they won't understand. And you will get creamed. You might be right. You might not be. I don't know. But the vast majority of scientists can't prove it, right? I mean, because they don't understand.
Right. Well, one thing that is common in both art and science, which are very similar, they're both creative pursuits. One does it more with numbers and logos, and the other does it more with emotion and pathos. But they're very, very similar creative pursuits. And Tesla is a great example. That was a person who had a mental model of how electricity functioned. Even though it was invisible to the eye, he could imagine how to make it work in terms of arranging magnets and wires in a way that was much more efficient than the DC motors, for instance. And he understood how it flowed through the earth. So he was this guy who was a genius when it came to that. That doesn't necessarily mean that he was good at communicating or good at putting into words that others could understand, particularly since English was a second language. So he was at a big disadvantage there. And then he was at a big disadvantage with Edison, who was, you know, kind of the Steve Jobs of the day, where he didn't actually invent many things, but he was this economic force that brought ideas together that other engineers had invented. And so he kind of stole a lot of Tesla's stuff. He kind of cast doubt about Tesla's sanity, and Tesla was not able to really communicate his ideas very well. But actually, more and more of them turn out to have been pretty accurate.
Yeah, and that happens a lot to scientists, where we just, because they're not like an artist, they're an artist. People can, well, that's not true. Artists are the same way. They'll be so far out there that you can't connect with them until maybe a century later. But right. Science, even almost even more so, if you get some kind of genius that's on the scene. But you know, I've seen, in my own personal, where I've worked at telecommunications, and we were on the bleeding edge of the internet at the time when it was building. And I've seen, I remember just this one situation where we needed to upgrade the network, and there was an old protocol that was so much slower. It had some, from a pure scientific standpoint, it might have been better, you know, the way it was written. It was just slow. So there were some really good things about it that the other ones didn't have, but we needed to upgrade our clients to a faster network. And the engineer that was responsible for managing this network became, and I've seen this many times, and I'm just using this as an example, he became almost religious about this technology, and it was his baby. He wasn't losing his job. He would just go to another place. Everybody was trying to take care of him, but he became religious about this particular technology, and I was amazed at the lengths that he went through to not let this thing go away. It was amazing, and I've seen that behavior, yeah, and that emotion in other arenas in science.
Right, and that's something that scientists call confirmation bias. And it's really kind of a normal human trait that's driven by our assumptions or our ego or our emotions. And the scientific method itself is designed actually to help us battle our own confirmation bias, to detect what's really real versus how we might be confusing ourselves into believing that something's real, which humans do all the time, including scientists. Mm-hmm. So the beauty of science is that it's a method that is designed to pull what we know out of our biases, no matter whether they're our emotional personal biases or whether they have to do with our religion or our culture or our gender or our ethnicity or our political views. Science is designed to kind of pull what's true out of all of that. But individual scientists working in the fray, you know, they have to guard against that tendency themselves. And sometimes it's really hard. And that's probably what your coworker there, your colleague, was experiencing. And that's a great example of that.
Well, and it's one thing of hearing it in theory. It's another thing of actually living through it and seeing it, because there's so much more, and then it creates emotion in the other people because they're so emotional, and then it's hard for you to, you know, it becomes a very difficult, challenging situation.
Yeah.
You know, theory versus reality is like, whoa, you don't even recognize that this is going on sometimes until you can take, you know, years later and you take a step back and you think about it.
Right. Yeah. He was too bought into, to his investment. Yeah.
But that's going on all over the place, right? I mean, people
being... Absolutely.
Well, there's another thing called the file drawer effect, right? Where scientists, based on economic or political pressure, if the results don't show up the way they want, they file it.
You know, that's not part of good science. That shouldn't be the case. The reward structure in science is... does skew science towards making the splashy discovery that changes the way people view things, not towards shows that we didn't get the result that we thought. But it's actually that negative work that is usually the most important in science, because it helps define where not to go, and it further eliminates and kind of carves out what may be the most likely path forward. But unfortunately, you're right that the reward structure of publishing right now does kind of skew the field towards that kind of bad science motivation. I don't know how many scientists engage in that, really, but I know that that's certainly kind of baked into the way that we have the system set up right now.
Well, and people aren't going to necessarily admit to it, but there's some studies out there showing that it's, you know, 25% of all scientists have felt the pressure to not publish things. But I know that if a company is doing it, you know, you need to have unbiased individuals doing the testing, because if it's their own company, we all know that if it's own company or industry, they have so much incentive to not put out negative information. Right.
Right. Well, especially if you're doing applied science and you're directing it towards a goal and there's a lot of economic investment that's happening towards that. Definitely. But that's, again, why you really rely in that case on other colleagues doing similar work, cross-checking each other with peer review, and even going, if something isn't too classified to the business model, going outside of the business to get a check from other people. So that you know that you're reliable, unless you can replicate it over and over and over again internally.
Well, then you know. Well, okay, some people believe that more gets done with an industry than in, well, it's not some people. I think there's facts to show that a lot more gets done in industry than in government and in educational institutions because of the politics involved. And so people are, some people believe, this is where I'm going with this, some people believe that putting the money into the government institutions or the educational institutions isn't a good use of our funds. What do you think about this? I mean, they have a point in the sense it's not as productive, but do we lose, you know, what are we losing with that? And what is the good point? You know, there's a pro, there's some pros and cons mm-hmm. there.
Yeah. Well, the thing about science is you never invest in it because you know what you're going to create. You invest in it because you don't know what you're going to create. Without government investment in science, we wouldn't have the internet, a multi-trillion dollar new economy. Without that, we wouldn't have a lot of communication protocols that you're talking about. It was government science that created the touch screen, for instance, that Apple used. So there, and a lot of people kind of confuse also the line between government science and industry, because a lot of startups come out of universities, especially these days where universities are more and more reliant on those revenue streams to support their mission. So I think that if you know, this was a very interesting discussion that happened during and right after World War II. There's a guy named Vannevar Bush who ran the Carnegie Institution, and he organized the United States science war effort during World War II. And they produced not only the atomic bomb, but they produced synthetic rubber, they produced radar, they produced a way to mass produce penicillin, they produced idea of using pesticides to prevent malaria, etc. So there were a lot of big breakthroughs that happened from that. So Vannevar Bush was asked by Roosevelt to examine this idea that he had proposed, that government investment in science should continue after the war. So Vannevar Bush did this paper that you can find right now, which was really breakthrough in a lot of ways. He's the first person, for instance, to describe a hyperlink in that paper. And he made the case for government investment in research in a post-war era and what it would do for economy, that it would continue to put the United States on the cutting edge. It would make us the undisputed superpower of the world, the global leader, and it would make our economy incredibly powerful. And if you look back on history before World War II, we were not a superpower. We were one of many countries. But that investment in scientific research massively changed our economy. Without that, we wouldn't have had all the spin-offs that then industry could capitalize on. Now, where government is most useful is in investments that there's no motivation for in industry. For instance, in public health research, which then industry can come along and capitalize on, or in environmental research. These things that are in the public interest, but are not necessarily, there's not necessarily an industrial motivation, at least yet. And then the other way that government science is really helpful is in basic research, which has a long horizon and high risk. So we don't know necessarily if we start having scientists, exploring fruit flies, for instance, if that's going to pay off. But we know that if we don't make the investment, we're not going to get those big breakthroughs. And time again, it's by funding scientific research into these obscure areas that we wind up with the huge economic or human health breakthroughs. And the problem with that kind of research in industry is that it's high risk. A lot, probably 70 or 80% of the dollars that are spent there are wasted because they don't go anywhere. On the other hand, the 20 or 30% that pay off have the potential to pay off in enormous ways, like creating the internet. Also, basic research is usually beyond the economic horizon that a company can afford to invest in, especially these days when quarterly returns are really driving a lot of industry. And it's hard to make an investment in research that has more than a three-year horizon. So without that kind of collective pooling of resources and risk through government research, we really can't invest in basic research that drives the economy forward. Yeah, but we have seen since that investment in World War II that that science and technology have driven more than half of the economic growth since then.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But what do you think about the research that's being done that's not transparent? You know, because government does a lot of research, but it's top secret and all the other stuff. And so they come up with a lot of advanced stuff. What is the process and there's some ethical issues there, right? Where tax money's used for research that's not in public domain and not going out to the general, you know, it's just certain industries or certain businesses that get that money. Or get that advanced.
Can you give me,
most of it's military stuff, I would assume, but so much of advanced technology comes out of the military investment. And so mm-hmm. when they do military research, they're using specific businesses to do that, and then that business gets it. And then it's kind of a competitive advantage for that group of, you know, so how do you deal with that? And what are your views on that? Cause they have a lot of advanced technology that the rest of the country doesn't get access to, right?
Well, they get access to it, but usually it's a little bit later. For instance, the internet, that was a DARPA creation.
DARPA is a good example. Well, internet's a great example, but internet's changing our world, right? I mean, it's completely changing life, but anyways, keep going.
Yeah, and it's created a class of billionaires that have been able to figure out ways to transform our economy, and you know, through creative destruction, that have vastly increased our efficiency. So that's a great example. DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, and it is engaged in military research, but it's also engaged in research that has broader defense applications that isn't necessarily top secret. So that's tension in that agency over what's public and what's not public, where our defense priorities lie versus taxpayer funds being used openly and transparently. But in the NIH, in CDC, in EPA, in all the large science agencies, the large granting science agencies, what they usually do, how they function, is basically they dole out money to universities and all research, and it's published then through a kind of with credit to them. But that is all open. That's all transparent generally. So there's an issue probably that has to do with balancing of ethics and priorities in the defense industry.
Yeah. And then figuring out who gets the, when it's all the taxpayer, there's ethics questions everywhere. I mean, one of the things that I told, you know, we talked about in my classes, we have the tsunami of technology that's hitting us. And there's a lot of ethical questions that we haven't worked through. And I had another guest on, Frank Sawyer, and he had a really good point. He was the head of, for the FBI, he replaced all the computer systems for before and after 9/11 for the FBI. Mm-hmm. One of the things he was saying was that our social systems, our social institutions haven't caught up to the advances in technology. And you know, we haven't figured it out yet. It's behind. But now we have this tsunami of more changes coming, and we haven't even caught up to the past changes. And I tell my students, you are going to be leading through this ethical, I mean, you think there's stuff now, wait until all this stuff really hits.
Right.
you know, well, aging. That's a big, and, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a huge problem that you've hit on there that I think is really coming to pose an existential challenge to democracy itself. Mm-hmm. Because we have, you know, through the internet now, scientists all over the world are collaborating with each other. They don't have to work in the same lab or in the same time zone, same geography at all. And at the same time, we have a huge increase in the number of scientists. So we are, over the next 20, 30 years, going to produce as much new information as we have since the beginning of the scientific revolution. And all of that new information is disruptive. And all of it needs to be parsed through our legal and our moral and ethical system. And the advances in technology around the internet are just a great example of just this huge explosion of power, which is really what it is, the power of big data and of analytics. And then questions about privacy and about freedom and about free will, even. If you can really predict how somebody's going to act by doing massive data crunching and then force them to act that way without their knowledge, is, you know, where do we get into who's responsible and who has free will and what does that mean for our legal system? You're right. We haven't begun to even think about these, much less grapple with them. And so this huge growth in what we're able to do with science and technology compared to, you know, the average person in the public that is voting elected officials in to deal with this, the gap is enormous and it's growing. So, you know, the idea that Thomas Jefferson had at the beginning of modern democracy, that wherever the people are well informed, they can be trusted with their own government, is really being challenged by that, because are the public still well enough informed? And if they're not, is democracy going to survive as a means of government? And if it's not, what do we do? What's going to replace it? So those are huge, huge, huge questions that I think that are really being driven by this next phase of the science and technological revolution that we're in.
Yeah, I think it's a big challenge. And I think that people are scared, frankly. And I think that's what a lot of what we're seeing is, people are terrified because they don't know, they don't understand it. It's kind of magic. And, well, I had a neuroscientist on, one of the best in the world, and he says that our ability to control messages just to your, you know, in marketing and things, we have gotten so good at that. That we're better, like, because I said, well, won't it be bad if we can, like, feed your brain direct messages on what to do? And he goes, well, we are already so good on cognitive psychology that it's probably better than just feeding your brain. And we saw that in the last election. And everybody, yes, because of the social media and the emotion that it created everywhere. And I can't see how that's good for our society, because people were voting, everything was emotional based for a large percentage. You know, there are people who still are cognitive and thinking about stuff, but such a large percentage of people were voting with emotion because they knew how to get at that. They're experts at it.
Yeah, exactly. Right. There's that whole field of politicians and how it's affected through science and technology, how it's affected our public dialogue is a fascinating field that really hasn't gotten enough attention. I would really encourage your listeners to seek out a BBC documentary. It's award-winning. It's very difficult to find in the United States, but it's called, you on YouTube, A Tree of the Self. And it really explores our
concept of the self. I'm sorry, repeat the title, because you...
And how...
Repeat the title, because it cut out there
first. Oh, sure. It's called The Century of the Self.
Okay.
And it explores this relationship between public relations, democracy, and technology that has really changed the way that we think about ourselves and about government over the last 100 years. It's a fascinating documentary. And I think that you're right, that the power of what we're able to do now through the research in social science and utilize it through the field of public relations is incredible. And most people have no idea that they're being manipulated when they are.
Yeah, they have no idea. And I showed my class an example of some frames of video where you splice it, you can show someone smiling. But if you show a scene of a you know, like say you have an older guy and he's smiling and you show a scene of a baby, you think he's smiling because of the baby. You show him smiling and then you show a scene of a young girl in a bikini, now you think he's an old pervert. You know, you can change the images that you give to people just by how you splice things. It's very powerful.
Right, exactly. And that's how Hollywood works, right? That's how we tell stories.
That's movies.
Yes, absolutely. Because our mind, that's movies, exactly. And our minds have evolved to interpret the world in terms of narrative. And that's how we create meaning, is by stringing events together. And when we have learned how to take advantage of that through movies and television and video, we've vastly learned how to manipulate people with that. That's something that happens actually anytime there's a communication revolution. It causes a social revolution and upheaval because new technology is kind of released on a public whose minds have not been prepared in ways to deal with it and don't understand its downside.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, there's a positive, there's a light side and a dark side to all of this technology. And we just haven't caught up. The ethics haven't been discussed.
Yeah, well, social media that you brought up is a great example, because here we've taken our public square, right, where everybody is entitled to stand up on a soapbox and speak their piece and convince other people that they're right. And we have moved that into a private sphere where it's being run to a certain extent by algorithms, and we're not necessarily aware of the effect that we're having on who gets to speak, how loudly they get to speak, and whether or not when they speak, it's garbled or it's understood clearly, how it's amplified. And then there are the possibilities of bots, of creating fake identities that populate that public square that say, no, you're wrong. So there are all these possibilities of skewing our public dialogue. And then in addition to that, there are certain companies who have done big data harvesting of Facebook likes, which are very predictive of the types of political messaging that you are vulnerable to. And by using this big data, then they can create a message that is personally tailored to you. And using algorithms, they can change all their messages, distribute that out in a mass way, and motivate you to buy a product or to vote a certain way. And you aren't even aware that the bots that you're interacting with and the messages that you're receiving are designed to manipulate you in that powerful way.
I don't think that the computer science, I have a computer science degree. I don't think those people who originally created Google and originally created, you know, I'm a business degree too. The people who originally created that stuff, they were thinking that they were going to end up doing this. I mean, I think they stumbled in some good technology. They're really excited about bringing all this stuff to the public. And the next thing you know, now they have this, they're in charge of these extremely powerful social manipulating things. And now they have, and whether they're even equipped to deal with all the pressure that's coming from the people who understand politics as well, right? Now you got the politicians who have power, the ultra billionaires coming in and affecting them and influencing how they're running their companies. We have a mess.
It is creating a mess. You're right. Science at its root really is a democratic process that increases freedom because it gives us more choices and it improves our power to control our lives. But at the same time, with big data now and with the internet, it's almost working in some ways in reverse, where it's creating the opportunity for large-scale authoritarian manipulation of the public.
Yeah, and that's where the ethics needs to come in, and we need to say, hey, you know, what is it that we're really about? Hey, I'm setting up some debates, some science debates. I want to bring in this objective, get some of these controversial issues out there, but I don't want emotional-based, political-based people. I want it to be a science debate on some of these more controversial topics. And I am requesting that you maybe help me find some people to be in those debates if you're willing.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about that. What kind of debate are you thinking about doing?
Well, I want to do one on climate change. I want to do one on vaccines. I want to do one on some of the ones that are really out there that people are, that are really affecting society. And we don't see, there's a website that's called, what's the name of that? It's a really good one that has like both, has the facts on different sides. But I want to be able to have some debates on this. It won't be a definite answer. That debate, whoever won the debate doesn't win. I mean, if it seems lopsided, or if somebody is just a better debater, then, and the, it just doesn't get their facts over, we have to make sure that we, you know, maybe do it again or something. But the point is to really get some of these arguments out there in a more objective, scientific way instead of the way it's happening now.
Yeah. And that's where the key is. And so I'd be happy to talk with you more about that. The one thing that it's important to avoid is setting up what's called false balance, where on one side of an argument is a scientist who's sort of dryly relaying all the accumulated knowledge won through all these thousands of experiments. And then the other side is someone who maybe has some science individual experience that they're passionately motivated to convince you that they're right, and they don't have the same level of support. So then what that can do is actually skew the public debate further away from the objective science and what it says by elevating the kind of the outlier position and acting as if there's a legitimate debate between those two and there's not. So in structuring it, that's really the important thing, that it's structured in a way that actually does promote the distribution of really objective knowledge.
Well, and that's the challenge, right? Because right now we don't have, because people, go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because people feel like things are crammed.
Oh, yeah,
down their
throat. You're exactly right. That's a challenge.
Yeah, it's a challenge. How do we do this and get it out there and do it objectively? And then also, and if somebody has a controversial, different, you know, solution or whatever, how do they look? How can they present it in a way that the others look at that objectively too? Because it's a, because we have some serious debates that need to occur.
Yeah, we do, and we have to understand the difference between. The important thing to do when having those kind of debates is to really open up the process. And this is something that scientists are really not often very good at. Science is all about really how we know what we know. And a lot of times the way that it's communicated or where that is taught, it's just that we're given these conclusions, like you just said, you know, cram them down people's throats. And that's the way that people often receive science when they're in science class. You know, here's the conclusion, it's in the book, you can redo the experiment, your goal is to reproduce what's already been done. Well, that's not really science, that's kind of just regurgitating, it's not really interesting, and it doesn't tell you really a whole lot about how we know things. So when we break it down, open up the process so that people can see why somebody's come to the conclusion that they have, and then debating those aspects with the process wide open, that's where it can be really constructive and really helpful.
Yeah, because otherwise we have some, like I say, social institutions are, we're having some problems in certain areas. Okay, so how can people learn more about you? You have a book that came out.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about you as we close here and where they can learn more, where they can get a copy of your book.
Sure, yeah. My book, the most recent one is called The War on Science. It's won a couple of awards now, and it's doing really well. And it explores all of the things that we've been talking about, as well as kind of the history of science and democracy and science in American culture. And it breaks it down into fun little bite-sized pieces. So you can find that either on, you know, on Amazon or at your local independent bookstore. You can also find it by going to my website, seanotto.com, seanotto.com.
Okay, great. Excellent. Thank you so much for joining me in this program today. I think it's really important with what I'm doing and a lot of the people that I run into. It's important to start to articulate this and understand what this is. So.
Exactly. Yes. And it's great that you're having these conversations.
Okay. Well, great. Well, have a wonderful weekend and thank you so much for coming to the show.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
And that's the end of the interview. If you want to find contact information for Sean Otto, it will be up on my radio page up on my website, sarahwestall.com. And this video is also available on YouTube and podcast and all over the place, over 100 different streaming channels you can get it on. Also, I air on Monday, Wednesday, Friday on the Global Star Satellite, which you can get all over the United States and in Canada, Hawaii, and Alaska. So you can get me pretty much everywhere. And you can hear that live streaming from my website at 3 p.m. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and 5 p.m. on Wednesday. So I want to tell everybody to have an amazing day.